The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Charthak. With us this week is Blair Horner, the Executive Director of the New York Public Interest Research Group, NYPIRG. Welcome back, Blair.
Thank you, Alan, for having me.
Well, you are so smart, and I love the fact that not only have you done what you've done with NYPIRG and made it into such an important facet of what we do in Albany, but that you've raised your children. That's important, isn't it?
Well, despite my best efforts, they seem to have grown up normal.
Well, let's talk politics. It's the 2019 session. Your analysis: legislation you like, legislation you don't, abortion, rent control, licenses for undocumented immigrants, voting reform. Take it, Blair.
Oh yeah. Well, just to take a look, even from 30,000 feet as compared to getting into the sort of the issues. In many ways, it was a typical session. Both houses passed about the same number of bills. The budget was negotiated in secret. Campaign fundraisers were occurring, at the typical pace. So in many ways, it felt like a normal session. In some other ways, though, it was significantly different. Both houses passed the same number of bills, but when they passed bills that they both agreed on, that number was up dramatically from somewhere in the neighborhood last year in 2018 of roughly 500 some odd bills passed both houses. This year it was over 900. And so you'd expect that, but there was a lot more agreement. The wild card in the session was really the way the Senate Democrats behaved. They were sort of much more interested in mixing it up. They had a lot of public hearings, which were, almost unheard of in Albany land. And sometimes they even had public hearings. I can remember testifying one on campaign finance where assembly members came and asked questions. So there was a different dynamic, largely as the result of the new Senate majority. And yet, in many ways, a lot of the normal sort of DNA of Albany in terms of secrecy, in terms of fundraising, in terms of the process, it was
ethics.
Very similar.
And
well,
ethics.
Well, they didn't do anything on ethics.
Exactly. Isn't that surprising?
No, it's sad, but it isn't surprising. They've made a calculation that the public, while horrified by what they read about in Albany, won't make them pay a political price for it. We'll see what happens. Next year is an election year, and who knows between now and then if something happens that forces their hand. I'm hoping it does.
Well, it's an interesting point about what happens. Now, the Democrats took the Senate. They've been waiting to do that for a long time. I believe they did it so largely on the back of Donald Trump and the fact that this governor, Andrew Cuomo, has decided that there was some physical utility, there's some philosophical utility in doing that and sort of switch sides. But what do you make of it? I mean, do they have the possibility, because there's a redistricting that will occur coming up, but they got to go through one more election cycle. And what scares a lot of Democrats is that they may screw it up and they may lose those marginal Democrats who won in Westchester and Long Island and places where conservative voters are in larger numbers than in the city. So what do you make of that?
No, I think that's a legitimate concern that Democrats should have, is that they moved too far to the left and they could alienate the sort of suburban voters where they have done very well. Westchester County now is almost entirely blue. Nassau County is almost entirely blue. Suffolk County is really a purple county. And the suburban counties where the action is, if the Republicans have any shot to take the Senate back or even to run competitively statewide. But your original point, I think, is the right one, which is for Republicans to swim in New York, they have to be able to do so with a cinder block named Trump around their neck. The president's unpopularity continues to plague them across the board, and it plagues them in the battleground areas, in the suburbs. So whether or not that changes in a year, I mean, who knows, right? It depends on who the Democrats nominate for president and how New Yorkers feel about all that. But I think what ultimately will make the difference in 2020 for the Senate is whether or not Donald Trump continues to stay at his, you know, in the cellar popularity ratings in New York. And if he does, the Republicans have a big problem.
Yes. So you agree with me that
always
that the Senate, Blair, turns out to have been on Trump's back. And those marginal districts, which are purplish, can still, even though they have Democratic voters, can still screw it up for the Democrats.
Yeah, I mean, some of the races on Long Island in particular, where no one was thinking anything was going to happen. So, for example, Senator Kemp Hannon, former Senator Kemp Hannon, chaired the Health Committee for many years. He'd been in Albany decades. He gets knocked out by the first, I believe, Indian American elected to the state legislature in a race that I don't think anybody would have predicted in early on. And so it wasn't that necessarily that the Democrats had a strategy across the board. I think it was the unpopularity of the president hurt them big time. And now the Senate Democrats have the biggest majority in decades of any political party and the biggest majority that the Democrats have had since the year 1912. And because they have such a big majority, I think it makes it far less likely that they lose control in the 2020 election. But again, it's a year out. Who knows?
Now, the Republicans have replaced Dick Nixon's son-in-law, Ed Cox, and brought on a more conservative, more pro-Trumpian guy from the upstate region. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, it was an interesting move that really is playing to the base. Ed Cox is a Manhattan, more Rockefeller-style Republican. You're right, he's related to the former president. But he's been involved in environmental issues. He was on then-Attorney General Andrew Cuomo's transition team, for example. So he's sort of, I don't know him well, but he seemed to be more cast in the Northeast Republican as compared to the more conservative Republican that you see in the rest of the country. Langworthy is from Western New York and from the area in particular where the president is still reasonably popular. And I think that's a move to play to the base. Now, he's much younger. There may be more grassroots excitement behind him. But Cox was able to raise a lot of money for Republicans. And whether or not Langworthy can replace that, I think, is an open question.
But is there a sense on your part that the Republicans may, in fact, by doing this, be shooting themselves in the leg?
I mean, time will tell. Obviously, when the team comes in last place, the manager gets fired, even if the manager is a great manager. And in this particular case, in the last election, 2018, the Republicans really got swept out. They lost congressional seats. They lost control of the state Senate. They lost assembly seats. They weren't competitive statewide. I mean, it was a terrible, terrible election for them in 2018. And so the manager got fired.
Let's talk about some of the specifics. Let's go, for example, to the fact that the abortion bill passed in both houses and basically ensuring that no matter what the Republicans do on the national level, New York will be a place. What do you make of that?
Well, I think Democrats, when they ran in 2018, ran against the Trump agenda. And so one of the issues is choice. I think they had to deliver on that. When I was looking at the session, there's two types of things that were happening. One was Democrats had to deliver on what they said they were going to do. And the second thing was, it was more sort of sub rosa, which was the legislature had to push back against the governor. Even though they're all Democrats, there is that sort of institutional pressure. So on some of the issues, abortion, Democrats, I think, were in the unity mode where they had to deliver on something that was a top priority national issue, and they did. And then there were other issues where the legislature teamed up, in a sense, against the governor by moving. So on rent control, for example.
And I want to talk about that. Rent control, maybe the most.
Some of the election law issues as well, where both houses came up with their own deal, so they didn't have to negotiate with the governor and trade for things that they wanted to get done.
I want to talk to you about that. The rent control, I have seen passion in Albany, but I think rent control is among the most passionate issues. People came up, they rocked the Senate doors, they were infuriated, they didn't want the status quo, they wanted some relief, and they got it.
Right.
And the governor had taken a great deal of money from the real estate interest, and he basically said to me when I asked him about it, how dare you? You know, I don't take money and I don't respond to that. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of the energy in the Democratic Party is what's going on in New York City, and the tenant activists, and you see it also on some of the issues around the election law issues. There was a lot of activity on the groups that were very deeply involved in knocking out a bunch of the so-called independent Democratic conference members. And I think that what's driving the Democrats, and it comes back to our original part of the conversation, which is, you know, can they go too far? But what's driving the Democratic agenda is what's happening in the city. And on rent control, I think Democrats would not, they had to go along with what the tenants really wanted. And they went much further, I think, than people would have predicted in the beginning of the session because of the energy of the activism in New York City. And that's, I think, a driving force across the board.
So has Cuomo lost his control of the Democratic Party? We see it, that there are these, there's this coming together, both the Speaker and the Majority Leader in the State Senate. And it looks to me like he may not be as in charge as a lot of people assumed he was.
Well, you know, New York State's governor, as you well know, is one of the most powerful executives constitutionally in the country. And so that power is not changed or diminished. I think the governor is going to have to evolve in his tactics on how he's going to deal with the legislature when they determine to team up against him. I mean, this happened, it's not necessarily just party control, it's institution to institution fights. In the third term of Governor George Pataki, as you may recall, there was a time when the former Speaker of the Assembly, Sheldon Silver, and the former Senate Majority Leader, Joe Bruno, teamed up to override a whole bunch, I think about 100 vetoes that the governor had done in the budget process. And so some of it, I think, is the third term fatigue. You start to see that. In this case, the legislature's decided that if they can team up on policy issues without the governor, they don't have to involve those issues in whatever negotiation they have. But I think the governor still is the dominant force in New York. And my guess is his tactics will evolve to respond to this new sort of strategy by the Assembly and Senate leadership to take issues off the table by coming up with two-way agreements that he can't veto.
So Blair, he's told me that he was running for a fourth term. What do you make of that?
Well, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, the governor, I think, likes being governor. He likes the game. He is very good at it. And so the last thing in the world you would want to do early in your third term is to take it off the table, because then people start viewing you as a lame duck. You know, how the public feels about it, I think, is really going to be the issue. If we have a Republican president when he's running for a fourth term, I think he's going to have a much greater chance to succeed. If we have a Democratic president, then I think it's going to be much harder. So we'll see, you know, in terms of how that all plays out. But the governor is going to be, I assume, is ferocious at the game. He knows how to use the levers of power. He's an aggressive campaign fundraiser, and he operates in a state where he has enormous constitutional powers and campaign contribution limits that are so high that he can raise more money as effectively than any Republican that can come in unless they self-finance. And so I think what's different from his situation than his father's is the state is even more blue, and that the president, if he's still president, is enormous liability to Republicans. I can't even see how they would come up with a challenge. The governor has to really worry more about his left flank than his right.
Talk to me about voting reform. There are some things I think that the Democrats could have done that they didn't. You know, they've been talking a good game for a long time. But now, for example, same-day registration, things like that. Why didn't they do that?
Well, they did a lot on voting reforms. These bills were sort of in the low-hanging fruit category. There's a lot of bills that both houses were able to come together on that had been blocked due to partisan gridlock over the years. It wasn't even ideological. It's just that nobody wanted to do things that unless there was a trade involved for something else. So there was a number of voting reforms. They did do first passage of a constitutional amendment to allow same-day registration. they passed bills to allow 16 and 17 year olds to pre-register to vote for their 18th birthday. They passed bills to allow early voting 9 days before the election. People will be able to cast their ballot early. So they consolidated the federal and state primaries. So they did a lot of things in that area. The most obvious thing that failed was there was a proposal that they had agreed on to basically set up a system of automatic voter registration where you would go to any time you interacted with the state agency, you'd be registered to vote unless you told them you didn't want to be. But that fell apart on some technical failures of the way the bill was drafted at the last minute. But on elections reform and voter registration, they did a lot. They passed about a half dozen bills across the board. Another one, they did first passage of a constitutional amendment to allow people to cast absentee ballots without having an excuse. So those two, same-day registration and the absentee ballot issue, have to go to second passage and then a vote by the public before they become law. But they did do a number of other things in addition to those.
Don't you think, Blair Horner, that it all comes down to a guy named Bernie the bartender? Bernie the bartender has been behind that bar for a long time, and he wants to run in his district. He knows almost everybody who's ever dropped in for a beer. The local assemblyman or senator, the Democrat of each of those designations, says, wait a second now. If we go too far, then Bernie the bartender may well run against me. So therefore, let's do some things, but not others, like same-day registration. They could have done that this year. They didn't do it, right?
Well, they did. Again, they did do first passage. It does require a constitutional amendment. The state constitution says you cannot register to vote within 10 days of an election. So if they're going to allow same day, they'd have to fix the constitution. But your fundamental point is right. There was the issue. The most notable on that was creating a voluntary system of public financing for elections, which has been at the cornerstone of what Democrats have said they wanted to do in the area of campaign finance, has been a cornerstone of what they said they wanted to do to deal with the issue of corruption in New York State. And then when they had the opportunity this year, because the Speaker of the Assembly has had a bill on public financing, the Senate Majority Leader had a bill on public financing, the governor's proposed public financing, they didn't want to do it. And that's because exactly what you just said, which is it would allow public financing for challengers to incumbent Democratic senators and assembly members. And so they hated the idea. And what ultimately turned the battle on that issue was the fact that the governor in particular was embarrassed by stories that came out of the New York Post and even more notably in the New York Times about a big campaign fundraiser he was having that was being held in secret. Where it's $25,000 a couple. And the Times sent a reporter who took pictures of the name tags of who was coming, and it was a who's who of the economic elite of New York City that were forking over money. And some of them were honest enough to say the reason they were going is because the governor was doing things that would help them economically. And so that embarrassed the governor and I think put pressure on the governor and the legislature to do something, and they came up with a commission to create a public financing system, which they have yet to choose, but is supposed to come up with a plan by December 1st of this year to have a voluntary system of public financing. But the point there is they didn't want to do it, even though they've always said they wanted to do it. And here was an opportunity to get it done. And had that not happened, those news reports, it's entirely possible nothing would have happened in that area this year.
So, Blair Horner, you know, there's always a possibility of a comma separating two houses bills. As we know, there's always the possibility that they can do what they need to do in order not to pass something. Are people getting tired of the same old, same old? I mean, the election of AOC, for example, is a pretty good idea of what frustration there is and the mobilization of some of the have-nots in the various districts, which could make a huge difference in the composition of the legislature.
Well, we saw it in the 2018 election. It's that the so-called Independent Democratic Conference of eight members was knocked down to two. And that was because of the activism, primarily in New York City, but even in a place called Syracuse, New York, which is not exactly, you know, the Socialist Republic of New York, right? I mean, it's definitely an area where you have voters of all types. In terms of the upcoming election, I mean, we'll see. I mean, the areas where the president is unpopular there are still state senators and state assembly members who are loyal to the president, and whether or not they pay a political price, we don't know. But ultimately, New York's sky-high campaign contribution limits act as a sort of a barricade that keeps voters out. And so we'll see how that plays out, but people are raising money hand over fist, and particularly the governor, who's raising a lot, enormous amounts of money, and that fends off any potential challengers. And so even if people are active, if they don't have a choice, there's not a whole lot they can do about it.
So a couple of things real quickly. The first of all, the higher education access. You know, when I went to Hunter College back in the day when the dinosaurs were freely, it was free, absolutely free. And you could look around and you could see people who, even if they had to pay $100, Blair Horner, would have not been in college. But they went, and it was good. I happen to be a huge believer. Then I know NYPERG is very interested in this.
That's right. I mean, and it's a sad tale because over the decades, there's been a significant shift of billions of dollars out of the state, from the state treasury, onto the backs of students and their families to pay for going to college. The policy of the state has been to automatically increase public college tuition every year, and yet at the same time keeping stagnant the operating budgets for the colleges and universities. So they end up using the tuition dollars to fill budget holes, which doesn't improve the quality of education, but it makes it cost more. The governor has advanced an interesting proposal through his Excelsior scholarship program, but that really has very limited utility. It's only covering, you know, maybe 30,000 students in public college out of a universe of upwards to 750,000 public college students. And so the state's tuition assistance program needs to be modernized. The governor every year in his budget proposed cuts to the so-called opportunities program, which are programs that help economically disadvantaged but otherwise educationally achieved students from succeeding in college. And yet every year he cuts the funding for that. So I think this is going to be a big issue, I think, next year, because a lot of these new legislators didn't know about the history on this. And I think the more they become aware of the yawning gap between the state's rhetoric and the reality of what it does, I think they're going to want to fill that, obviously, within the context of what the state can afford. But I agree with you wholeheartedly. In the 21st century, a key ladder, economic ladder of success, is college and increasingly graduate school. And if, to the extent that you're creating financial barriers, you're just basically keeping economically disadvantaged people out of that, off that economic ladder, and that's not right.
I'm sorry to do this to you, Blair Horner, and I know that, you know, you have some affection for this governor, but is this a phony program that he's established where so few people, even though it's been sort of promised more than it could deliver, is this a phony program?
Well, I mean, for the people who benefit from it, it's not, right? The way
it's a relatively low number.
But it's a very small number, relatively small, and it's primarily benefits more middle-income families. The income level is up to over $100,000 now, and so that's sort of bootstrapped on top of the state's tuition assistance program, which is an entitlement program, which basically means that the lower your income, the bigger the financial aid, so that if you're at the lowest income level, tuition is covered. But there's a lot more cost to going to college than just tuition. There are fees, particularly in the state university. A lot of those campuses can have very high fees, thousands of dollars. Housing, books. I mean, there's a lot of cost to going to college beyond tuition. So New York should do everything it can to sort of deal with making it easier for particularly economically disadvantaged students and their families to afford going to college. So I wouldn't say Excelsior is a phony program. It benefits the people it benefits. It is just an issue, a program that benefits on the margins. It's not a central driver in making college affordable to the masses of students who need the help.
So I only have a couple of seconds here, but I want to ask you about the climate change law that the legislature passed. Is it for real?
Well, the goals are. I mean, New York is very good at having environmental goals. They're not great at achieving them. And so there are goals in this bill that passed, which basically require that 100% of electricity in New York by the year 2040 will be generated by non-fossil fuel-powered sources. By the year 2050, there'll be an 85% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. All of those things are appropriate and needed. I mean, we are living in climate change right now. And the question really by the end of the century will be, is the future going to be grim or catastrophic? Those are the choices. We're trying to keep it in the grim category. And the only way to do that is to get off fossil fuels. So the goals are right. But there's not, there really was very little in the legislation about the details.
And 2040, that's a long way off.
That's,
you know,
right, that's right.
As Mario Cuomo used to tell me all the time, by that time, a new pope could be born,
that's
and
right.
these guys won't be there anymore, so they don't have to worry about
that's
it.
That's right, that's right. And so the key, really, the metric that's going to matter, they appoint a 22, they're going to appoint a 22-member advisory council to figure out the details, is what New York needs is a very public, very clear annual report card on whether or not they're moving in that direction. What is always missing is that accountability measure. Who's going to independently verify the greenhouse gas emissions are going down over the next 30 years into, let's say, 90% reduction? You got to see 3% reductions every year. Is that happening? Are we going to be moving toward 100% fossil fuels in the next 20 years? That would mean 100% in 20 years is 5% every year. So what are we hitting those goals? And the governor can do that through his executive power to annually put out a report card on whether or not we're moving toward the directions of the goals of that legislation.
Hey, Blair Horner, I have just 2 minutes, maybe a minute, for mass transit. The congestion pricing that follows on much of what you're talking about here in New York City, is this a real program? Is it going to happen? Will there be hell to pay as a result?
Well, the congestion pricing issue is really a way to do two things. One is to generate revenue for the nation's most extensive mass transit system, without which the city can simply not operate, and to create economic disincentives for people to drive. So it will achieve both of those things. It will help fund the necessary tens of billions of dollars, but it is by itself insufficient to meet the economic needs of the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, and it will create disincentives for people to drive into the city. But it's not the solution to the economic woes that plague the MTA, and it is. But it is a significant amount of resources to help meet those goals. But it's not enough. The state is going to have to come up with more dough. It's very straightforward on that.
Blair Horner, we are so lucky to have you as our go-to guy. Blair Horner is the head of NYPERG. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Alan.